So you're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Kingel. We're back.
You join us for the second part of our discussion of urbanism. And having set out those 10 chapters worth of general principles and historical analysis and statistics and cuttings from newspapers.
Graphs,
all sorts of...
big square, little square equals little square, big square.
Yeah. All sorts of principles. Do you want to
recap for the people? I know for us it's been about 45 seconds, but for them it's probably been about 3 weeks given our general editing schedule.
Actually, we could just do the general principles which he's outlined, which are...
Grid. Man is in a cosmic order. He must overcome nature. Things must be in grids.
Yes.
Primary shapes are good, not only aesthetically, but morally.
Yeah. The historic city, we've got to... put it in order to allow the circulation of traffic. That's one. We could do this as a kind of a quiz, if I can remember.
Yeah, well, I'd say there's still some general points, which is that, like, we want great rooms in the city. We want our, like, you know, the city should be all alike in detail, but in variety of urban spaces.
Yeah.
It should be full of trees. Yeah. And then it's the actual specifics of the city, which is that great cities are really vital to culture.
Yes.
It must be unblocked.
It must be decongested,
cut through and opened up. It must be green and have lots of green spaces. It must have tons of transport and speed.
Yes.
And
it must densify.
It must be super dense in the centre so that, like, the evolutionary process can be accelerated.
This sort of quasi-magical way of thinking about what goes on in the cities is pretty general, actually, isn't it?
People have stupid theories for things they don't understand, and it's very hard to understand cities because they're very complex.
There isn't really any way of understanding, is there? So, I mean, you do always end up with various kinds of magic. That was always my view of the 90s discourse around iconic buildings and the idea that
the Bilbao effect.
Yeah, the Bilbao effect. Cities would be magically sort of transfigured from post-industrial dereliction and sadness into hip, cool suavity by the construction of a few significant, symbolically futuristic and avant-garde baubles of various kinds.
You can see why architects would like that. And given that they were the main people saying it...
It's convenient. I don't think they even were the main people saying it. I think it got taken up by
planners
who were
like...
by a whole other kind of snake oil discourse.
Well, we could try and do something hard, or we could just bung some money at someone.
No, well, it also was like classic sort of 90s technocracy. You know, let us not concern ourselves with the hard grinding work of addressing social problems and all of this kind of thing. Let us instead focus on the media-friendly spectacle of governance.
Yeah, it's kind of postmodern. The image is reality.
The sort of super criticality of lots of people in the same place rubbing together and creating extreme civilization.
Well, that's what the city actually is.
Well, it is. That's what it is in Corbusier, isn't it? That's the reason why we still need cities at all.
Yeah, it's not quite that sensible, though. It's a bit cosmic order as well. I know I keep banging on about cosmic order, but it's kind of useful because we think of him as so rational. I don't think we necessarily need to go through the book. I've got a couple of images in the book that I'd like, but I think this was what was laid out in the pavilion of the Esprit Nouveau. One side of it was a presentation of these two proposals, and the other side was like, in theory, a one-to-one scale unit.
One of, presumably...
three or four types.
Well, I want to say something first, which is that the Esprit Nouveau pavilion in 1925 isn't the first outing of this particular proposal. This one had been submitted first to the Salon d'Automne in, I think, 1923. So I think what happened is he did the Maison Citroën in 1922, and then I think this is what he did for the year after.
It's a ville contemporaine or something. Why don't you pronounce it properly?
Une ville contemporaine.
Oh, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah. Can't do R's. It's really bad. Well, let's describe it from the way in which it first appears, which is this plan, well, at an extremely great scale, from an extremely great height. And what appears is this broadly rectangular figure. Yeah, I see what you got. That your one is really distorted.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more distorted even than you think, actually.
Yeah. So they did that in every English language edition.
So, well, I'll describe the way it's meant to look. It's a rectangular figure in the centre of a series of intersecting diagonal routes, and it's arranged. It's extremely reminiscent of like of these plans of Peking / Beijing, depending on what era you're in, or
it's for our listeners in the early 20th century,
or equally like Kyoto or something like that, a rectangular city plan oriented on the cardinal points of the compass, and then in the case of this city, those are then all also bisected by things going on the 45 degree angle. So that grid that you've got on your plan is those should be all at 45 degrees. And the thing itself should actually be a rectangle, which is a bit wider than it is high. So that in contrast to these East Asian archetypes, where the principal axis is north-south, and they tend to be higher than they are wide, this is on its side and is wider than it is tall. What you're seeing is this very strong graphic geometry. In the middle, there are these cross-shaped forms, and then around that there is sort of broadly, I mean, it's a broadly kind of circular zone of kind of like stepping kind of jigsaw-shaped forms, and then the outermost corners of the rectangle are these sort of rectangular block forms. And then the whole is, well, it's situated actually in, there's a kind of countryside around it, isn't there? It's situated within within a city area, within a kind of zone.
Yeah, there's that, and then actually beyond that, in theory, there's another layer of sort of garden city. But quite rightly, it's not imagined in free space. There is a canalized river. There's a sort of agriculture beyond. And there is also little scraps of sort of the previous urban condition off in one corner, which are kind of imagined to still sort of be there amidst this new city.
We should say this plan is described as a city, a contemporary city for 3 million inhabitants. In fact, what we see in this plan is only a city for 1 million inhabitants, because it's cropped off the cité jardin, these kind of suburban excerpts, which are meant to contain 2/3 of the population.
Well, but in fact, I think the grid of roads that otherwise make no sense around the outer side of it are just full of garden city.
I think that the garden city is just off the edge of this plan.
Are these the garden cities?
I think they might be creeping in a tiny bit. One of the key ideas about how this is structured is that there is a really big buffer between the city gardens and the city itself, that they have to be insulated from the noise and, you know, potential sort of nervous disturbance of the city by a buffer of some 12 kilometers or something.
Built area is incredibly sparse. It's just an enormous amount of wilderness.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you've got this thing that looks like a computer chip, basically. And it has some slightly more granular detail to it. There is a sort of centre of culture around a massive square in the middle with four towers in it. There's a great park taking up some 20% amidst this garden city. There's the obligatory airfields and, centres of recreation.
He talks in various places about these subdivisions of the population of the city. So I think that this kind of top-level division of people is people who live in the city and work in the city, people who live in the suburbs and work in the suburbs, and people who live in the suburbs and work in the city. And I kind of think he might think that there's a million of each of those. And then within this central rectangle, there is this division into three again. There is what we raised already, these enormous 60-story towers.
Or even more, 100-story.
With a cross-shaped plan, of which there are 24. And then there are two sorts of apartment building.
Well, they're both the same height. They're both 6 double stories.
Oh, I think
one can be more, but actually isn't. When you see the Axos, they're always the same height.
Yeah, they're pretty similar. I think one is meant to be 6 and one is meant to be 5. And everything is duplex, though. So.
And essentially they have two differences with each other. One is a sort of, it wiggles, is like an S shape with right angles, and it has double height balconies, and one is rectangles, blocks, so with a courtyard in the middle, and they have courtyards that go right through the building. So with two aspects, which are, so each flat is two stories tall, two thirds of it is flat, and one third of it is a double height garden, which goes right through the block. The rest of the land is mainly actually used for like agriculture and recreation. In the centre of the city, there really isn't any of that. I think it's just English garden. I think it's just landscape garden, basically. But with enormous amounts of transport infrastructure. There are five levels, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, these principal traffic routes, they're segregated in lots of different ways. The lowest level is heavy goods vehicles.
No, the lowest level is intercity trains, I think.
Oh, right, yeah. So intercity trains, suburban trains,
commuter trains.
Like metro trains, which stop. The city is set up with this grid of 400 metres, and I think the metros are meant to stop every... Or they're meant to stop at every intersection of the roads. Yeah, and then for traffic, you have a separation between delivery vehicles and private motor cars.
And then there are two separations for private cars, one of which goes at a minimum of 60 miles an hour all the time and is like these super motorways everywhere. And then there's the local road system, which is separated by height. And all these things actually go through the buildings, or the buildings have bridges over them. No one ever carries anything into a building. Everything is delivered by lifts. So every building has got these interchanges. And they also, all the buildings really have ways of getting light aircraft onto them so that they can be shuttled to and from the airport. So there's this huge web of massive roads and rail everywhere, suffusing the city. Here's a description of the experience of driving through it, where he's encountering various things. You know, he has these imagined journeys where you're swept in at amazing speed. The city is so, the aesthetic experience is so exciting because you encompass this amazing change because you're going so quickly. So you rattle through suburbia, through these different categories of space, and you experience wonder at the changing like environment. You experience his promenade that he has through buildings just with great speed. You also experience all of these intersections where you suddenly, you know, spiral down from the super fast thing on a loop into the local road. And then your car goes into your building. All buildings have big car parks underneath them. The car parks are never in open land. They're always sort of buried. And all the buildings have got a lot of kind of buried infrastructure under them. The service station for the servants who served all the service apartments. The huge cold rooms for the kind of concession store which buys things in collectively from the countryside. Vehicle maintenance stations are all in this Vulcan depth.
So the entire pulsating centre of the city is all condensed. It's not really separated. The 24 towers contain a mix of everything. It's all in there.
Yeah, it suggests that they are for industrial, business and residential use,
yeah,
and leisure use.
Well, there's 600,000 people living in the 24 towers, I think.
Yeah, so. And actually around the 24 towers usually has a low-level ribbon of buildings, which may be specialist sort of cultural buildings or something.
It's important that these are these monumentally vast buildings surrounded by enormous expanses of landscape garden.
95% open.
Yeah.
And all the roads, except for the local roads, don't touch the ground. So actually, you've got to imagine it is at the ground floor as almost unbroken landscape garden, which has, at a high level, viaducts on stilts.
I think that there's a mistake that people make potentially where, because the descendants of this vision in post-war planning are things which lots of people have experienced, perhaps we underestimate how different from them the actual scale of this vision is. This is like an order of magnitude more excessive.
Like anything that has been built that's like this has been value engineered. So you just don't have that much transport infrastructure. You don't have that much open space. The towers aren't that tall. They don't have all the mod cons. And infrastructure isn't all buried or raised. So his vision, essentially, you could walk without really crossing a worrisome road or rail thing from one end of the city to the other in essentially completely open garden. So you'd be walking through this landscape of massive buildings, but an open landscape. And I think he also imagined that there would be, even in the zone, say, of all towers, or of all, that there would be changes.
I think we should imagine this this garden as also being full of little pavilions and restaurants and things. It's the place for entertainment and diversion of all kinds. Tennis courts, you know, all these
little sort of belvederes where you sit up and have coffee and look over in wonder and excitement at this rugged landscape of trees extending for miles amidst the great gleaming glass towers.
I mean, and are we also looking at quite a clear hierarchy? I mean, I think we are, aren't we?
I think, in a way, he has a sort of an idea in mind of the social structure of the city, but to him, that's not the key point. I think the idea in mind he has is that the capitalist class will live in the towers and have villas on the outside, and they will have their businesses in the same towers, sort of thing. All that kind of commercial core class, and then the kind of clerk class will either commute in from the Greenbelt or, you know, and perhaps, sort of different notions like that, but I don't think it's really articulated. I think he's not trying to upset the social order.
No, definitely not. I think this is envisaged slotting very comfortably into an existing social order.
Yeah, but I also don't think he'd mind if it was I think he'd be perfectly happy with it being a fascist run paradise or a communist paradise or whatever.
Yeah. As long as he gets to build the buildings.
As long as he gets to build a massive thing. I think the mode of social... He has a sort of mode of social organisation in mind, which I would say probably is essentially just conservative.
Yeah.
But that's not the key point for him.
The cruciform skyscraper is a strange one, and it's not really one that anyone has spent a lot of time with.
Well, lots of people built three triform ones. Which work better. The cruciform ones have some terrible shading on one of the sides of the cruciform where all the flats get no daylight ever. Whereas the sort of tricorn version, which I think has been built fairly extensively, I mean, not at that size.
All the circulation goes up and down the core, yep. And then you have these corridors heading out, and then to describe it in more detail, the arms of the cross also have a kind of serrated profile, which I think means that light can come into, can kind of come closer to the inner corridor.
Yeah.
As well as going out to the flats.
I mean, it also is a bit like sort of trick, it's almost like Ruth Franklin, you know, which employs a similar thing. It's almost like a giant bay window.
I was thinking about it because it's interesting that although he does do mass housing later in his career, he never doesn't actually really want to do towers. I think he has a go at them here, but he's already struggling with... I think he's sort of struggling against another inclination of his, which is actually that he wants the main organising axis of these things to be horizontal rather than vertical, and that horizontality is much more...
He's reaching toward the street and the sky, I think. And they don't really work. People have had a go at them in high rise. You know, you can bridge between things at some high level. You can bridge between a few towers and have, like, something for photoshopped people to kind of run around in and sip coffee around swimming
TVs
pool
off,
suspended at the 40th story. But it's not entirely plausible. Yeah, well, I think the reason he doesn't ever build them is because I don't think they'd be any good.
No, it doesn't seem that good, does it?
In fact, the whole city, it has some major problems, doesn't it? How should we talk about this city? Like, look up pictures of it. He did a lot of great images, either perspectives. There's lots of great axos. I expect we'll put some up.
We're focusing on the towers. We can talk about the other flats when we talk a little bit more about the Esprit Nouveau Pavilion, because
the funny thing, another thing about to mention about the towers is he, like the two other forms, he plans them. He has drawn them out to a point where you can imagine where the furniture goes. The tower, he never plans at all.
The tower's totally generic, isn't it?
He never plans. He says industry, business, and people are going to live in them, but he never even really attempts to show how.
You know, it's just a diagram of extreme densification.
Not just, it's also to be viewed from the landscape garden.
In that sense, it has a little bit in common with that ambiguous techno-futuristic city of a similar period, the one by Ludwig Hilbersheimer, where everything is reduced to cuboids, basically. this kind of cuboidal hive.
The difference is the landscape garden. Hildesheimer City is like a circuit diagram. He has no place for trees. One thing we should go through actually from the book is his arguments for and against and how it works.
The way it's structured in the book is that we have this outline of the city, and then it's structured around these two chapters, the hours of work and the hours of leisure. The hours of work are really retreading a lot of arguments around circulation and the need for people to move as fast as possible. The hours of leisure are, again, about the garden. He has this idea that human scale, we need some human scale in this city of these monstrously vast crystalline monoliths, and trees are going to do it. Or his characterization of what makes cities good is completely
wrong.
It's completely fanciful. It's completely tendentious. The idea that you could decant all of the activity of the city into these enormous towers and it would continue to function in the same way, I think it should be sort of self-evidently clear that that's not going to happen. It's not that there's only one particular way for a city to exist. I very much dissent from this kind of Jane Jacobs-inspired view that there's a particular way that streets work and everything has to work like that. I think if you go to cities like Tokyo, there are lots of places which have very unlikely sort of forms of urban forms and circulation and things which actually function very well. But I would be very uncertain about the success of...
No, it's terrible. It's terrible.
It's got these enormous towers.
He works against density. He works against accident, which is, I think, one of the points of density is that things are brought together whether they like it or not. What forces interactions to happen and work, is that there is the potential for chance. And he has eliminated chance by the fact that if you're going on in a tower, there is always a wall separating you. There is no public space. And the public space is so vast, dense, and empty, and so suffused with transport infrastructure. And your interactions are all designed so that you never have to go on a street and interact with someone. Everything is delivered immediately to your house. Everything is centered around the home. His reclusive general work life is highly reflected in his ideal for human habitation, which is that occasionally you will venture out of your home and do great work and then return, and everything is brought to you. There is such a limited capacity in this for you to go out and create potential.
The space in which that kind of character and accident is going to happen is this enormous English garden with its winding paths, which somehow is going to be... There will be a kind of charming and characterful restaurant around every corner, in spite of the fact that you've probably had to walk about 800 metres.
Or... in spite of the fact that there have to be 60,000 of them, or some grotesque number of pavilions, all presumably exactly the same.
It's incredibly dense, but the vision for the kind of vision of a life is a suburban one, isn't it? You know, you've got your little
monastic.
You've got your little module, you're hygienically separated from everyone else, and you go point to point and fulfil activities on this little atomised itinerary.
But it's also monastic. It's about cells and contemplation of vast scenes.
There are different sorts of objections that you can have, aren't there? There's one where you can just sort of say that in entirely sort of uprooting and reconstituting the urban form, you've actually destroyed everything which makes a city a city. And maybe a less emphatic way of objecting to it is just saying that because of these peculiar obsessions that he has, this is a city which is monstrously over-endowed in some things and monstrously kind of under-endowed in others. He's identified a real problem in cities, which is, or a real problem for the 20th century city, which is the intrusion of the motor car and the traffic and the noise and the pollution which it causes. But I think that, like, all of the really great, or certainly the majority of the really great eras of 20th century urbanism are attempts to accommodate rather than to frustrate that. One of the things I find a bit strange about this is that in his architecture, he's not all that excessive, is he? But he has quite a good... One of the things you see in his domestic architecture is the rooms are not super massive. They tend to be quite carefully scaled. They don't dwarf you. So why is everything in his urbanism so sort of over the top? Why does he think that everyone wants 3 square kilometers of tennis courts next to every house?
My theory for it is it's going back to the monastery that he likes, is that you are in a monk's cell made nicer in a sublime landscape of rugged cliffs and monumental forms, and your relationship of your smallness to its bigness is inspiring and sublime.
Which I guess it is. I mean, it's a nice thing to look across an enormous metropolis, but this one is, there's nothing to do.
No, it's like a mountain range. Yeah. It's like being a monk in a mountain range, except that there are various accommodations to the fact that you're in a city. But I think that was the way he mostly lived his life, is that he had an interaction with the sublime and an interaction with the humane at a level. And that was what he... And he wasn't a great... I don't think he went down the pub every, you know, twice a week. I don't get the sense that he, like, was a member of a bowling club. Or... I mean, I think he sort of did cycle around and spend time in cafes and things, which I guess is a kind of equivalent. But I don't think he ever really considered it. And I think you can see, even where he is not really... Where the locusts of his... Where his attention isn't, you can see some problems. His attention isn't in the design of actually what goes on in the towers. Yeah. He doesn't care. They just have to be there. His attention isn't really in the parkland. I've never seen a drawing of parkland that is at all convincing in terms of how the pavilions work. Sure, there are these things here, and then in the big thing, they're all exactly the same. Yeah. Or they're like super... I've never seen this drawing of like how the parkland is really... His attention's not there. It's not in the towers. It's not in that. His attention is in how a slab block works with, like, loads of transport and how the flat in the slab block, like, all relate to each other.
But the problem is it's not really a monastic vision, is it? Because it's a bit like being a monk in Versailles or something. Yeah, it's not Mount Athos. It's this enormous manifestation of order and grandeur. And it has some sublime elements because of the inhuman scale of the buildings.
No, but I think those are the things he's struggling toward. I think those are the things he likes. He likes saying the building should be a long way back from the road and much, much higher because that's more sublime. I mean, what's the other advantage of it? The density is not really improved very much. But by doing that, you're not actually really improving the density. You're just making the buildings bigger and further apart. Yeah. Normally, we would like to say... I would say the orthodoxy now is that you want moderately big buildings right close together. Yeah.
There are loads more drawings of this than you've probably seen.
I think the nice ones are the best bits of design are the design of the slab blocks. Yeah. That's where the best thinking is.
So should we discuss the Plan Voisin quickly?
Shall I articulate the conceit and then you can talk about it? Because I think you've probably got more thoughts in line. So the conceit is this, that the centre, the historic centre of Paris, the Marais and things, is going to be over time replaced with a grid of these super big towers with parkland between them. And this is going to be achieved by first demolishing the little 5% of land that the towers are on, building the huge towers, moving everyone out of their existing buildings into the towers, and then demolishing the 99% of not very interesting Paris, according to his notion, and replacing it with scrubland and huge motorways, keeping some little bits of little historic buildings. And, you know, over the course of 30 years, that will be achieved. And then the centre of the city will be much improved with these huge tower blocks. It was sponsored by a manufacturer of cars and aeroplanes, Voisin, as a provocative speculation into what could be a future of cities and a promotion of the ideals of the mechanical age of cars and planes and things. It was the most controversial part of the Esprit Nouveau pavilion in the exhibition.
The thing I want to start off talking about is the difference between the Plan Voisin and the City for 3 Million, because although they contain lots of the same elements, they've distributed in a slightly different way in the Plan Voisin. There are some other things to talk about. We're looking at this big lavishly detailed axonometric, which we'll put up on the Instagram, which you should be following if you aren't already. The Plan Voisin, in some ways, is stripped down. In some ways, contains some sort of slightly different elements, and I think it's interesting to talk about what they are. The insertion is within and is contained by the fabric of the existing city. So it doesn't, as the City for 3 Million does, have this gradient shift out into absolute green parkland at the edge, but rather ends quite abruptly. So it's surrounded, and the grid of roads is tighter as well, I think partly to try and integrate with the existing city plan. Don't you think?
Yes, I think it's a little bit denser, and it doesn't have the suburbia because it's plugging into the suburbia of Paris. Although I don't think he ever really intellectually integrated the suburbia and the city. He has a 1 to 500 scale, or maybe even 1 to 200 scale understanding of the suburbia. Probably 1 to 500 scale. But he never manages really to understand how that interacts.
The drawing of the suburbia in the City for 3 Million is completely linear drawing of these looping motorway routes and then just some writing on it. There's not even motorway
routes, they're trains. He says it's going to have a set of four circular...
They're not actually in the plan, as we said, but already the City for 3 Million plan really only shows the most important million.
It has the bright light of the city where the strong are raised up and the weak are crushed. Yes. It doesn't have the bucolic, peaceful hinterland.
Where the weak labour in obscurity, growing their parsnips or whatever. I think we could talk a little bit about this drawing because it's an interesting one. You can tell where it is only by there's a very little bit of existing city fabric distributed around the edges. So we can see coloured in like very grey and very bleak looking. But there's a tiny little bit of it in the extreme top right and extreme bottom left. The emphasis on circulation is conveyed through the fact that we can see millions of these tiny little cars, but which all appear almost as sort of mouse droppings, these little black dots scattered across. And they, in places, well, you know, where the actual edges of the roads are meant to be, is quite obscure. And it's really just indicated by these sort of flow of iron filings. You can see they're sort of streaming. Sometimes they seem to
move in a circle. Just a big road. I think the cars can drive all over the square.
Yeah, they seem to be. The square, which is the centrepiece of it, is ringed by slabs. It's super massive. What is the square? The square is... It's about 600 by 300, I think, the square. Well, it has very significantly the shadow of an enormous aeroplane passing across it. And it also has marooned in it some little bits of sort of quasi-Roman symbolic fragment. It's got these two Arc de Triomphe-looking things. It's unclear to me whether they are recovered or moved or... just built from scratch.
Built from scratch. The City for 3 Million has huge arches over the entrances.
And it's also got these two huge columns.
Oh yeah, obelisks or chimneys. Little bits of sort of Tuileries-style garden.
Although it's a square, because it's got this huge dual carriageway going through the middle of it.
How many lanes has that road got, do you think?
Well, they're not observing very good lane discipline.
But I think it's about seven or eight in either direction. Oh no, it's way more than four, look.
It has a flyover in the middle.
But don't worry, you can't walk under the flyover. No, that's just for more cars. It has three layers of motorway on top of each other in the middle.
And then otherwise, the big module of the Plan Voisin is the cruciform skyscraper, but this time sitting on a relatively small island of greenery, which is probably about 200 by 200. And we were talking earlier about what these linear... they look a bit like kind of shortbread biscuit things scattered around the base are. They think that there's something to do with the traffic infrastructure because people seem to be driving off the roads into them. It's not clear what they are. They look like maybe enormous bus stops.
They look like a bad idea. A lot of this looks just like a bad idea. The more I think about it...
Not a great place to live.
Right, you had observations about the advantages of this.
The advantages?
As opposed to the City of 3 Million.
Oh, I'm not sure they're exactly observations of advantage. I think that in comparison, there's generally, because they're so obviously related, I think that something you can miss is that they are clearly foregrounding or accentuating different qualities of the scheme. So in The City for 3 Million, it's really all about the parkland and the greenery and this green cordon sanitaire between the inner city and the outer suburbs, and the garden-like experience of walking through the parkland and seeing these enormous skyscrapers in their crystalline magnificence. I think other things are accentuated in the Plan Voisin. I think that the circulation...
Roads, motorways.
You know, this drawing, which is really all about cars, and self-evidently the idea of urban clearance and rebuilding is really the key structuring provocation. I think upon reflection, the parkland is a more significant part of the legacy of this scheme than any other element. Not because the other things didn't happen, but because I think they would probably have happened anyway. Whereas this seems to me to be something which is more specific to this particular formulation of the new city and its planning. I mean, I think another way of approaching this is to say, what does the world look like in when neither of these schemes was ever proposed and people had to draw on other influences? And I think, though, what would have still have happened and what would have happened differently? That, I think, is my rationale for thinking that The City for 3 Million potentially has a greater influence.
Because it has more parkland?
Because I think the parkland is the thing which I can imagine not being there.
The focus from the mid-19th century on, both practically and theoretically, of the garden and the green as what was lost in the process of the construction of great cities. So the hay wain, driven out by mechanisation and improvement, is driven into the dark satanic mills and loses the bucolic idyll. In England, at a practical level, the parks movement, the garden cities movement, the movement to give allotments... The urge towards green is incredibly strong. The idea, I think, that a new city should have green throughout the centre, I'm not sure is so radical. But the idea that you should demolish the centre of Paris to put green around the towers is, I think, a very unusual move.
Yeah. Are there other key drawings that we want to talk about?
The Base Invader plan. I'll describe the plan and then you can talk about your thoughts, because I think you've probably got more thoughts than me. This is a rectangular plan, slightly more stretched. It's about the shape of a foolscap piece of paper. It is divided in two. The bottom half is the Marais in Paris, with a huge motorway has been driven through it at an angle.
It's an aerial photo.
And the top half is this grid of the huge cruciform skyscrapers. There are 4 of them complete, but there's sort of notions of bits more of the grid. And the grid itself is actually squashed at an angle. The top is very white and the bottom is very black, giving it very strong graphical appearance with this motorway cut through. There's a bit of granularity to the top half with some sort of other buildings and things, but it's mainly this repeating unit of the tower, the strange clone stamp ground format around it.
The entourage, if we're going to do the Beaux-Arts.
But it feels very digital. Tower, cruciform, its shadow, the roads around it, they all seem to have the same grim collection of tussocks, transport infrastructure, loop, spiral. And that's against the grain, the dark grain, as he would call it, of the seventh circle of hell. Prosperous inner city of Paris with its tight streets, irregular grid, courtyards. And it looks like one is erasing the other. It's the edge of it is a real crystal boundary. They're coming down and they are eating it. It's an amazing image. Yeah. It looks very much like something that could be produced, I mean, basically at any point, actually, in modernism. But later on, it would be a comment, whereas now it's a literal proposal. This is something that I think Rem Koolhaas could have done. It's something that Rossi sort of did do. It's something, and I think it could come up various periods before, but here it is not presented with a nod towards the ironic relationship with history, which I think if it was Rem, he would be making a comment about time, about space. This is about superiority. This is about, it's almost Nietzschean, one thing overcoming the other, for me.
The grid has been distorted so that it's a kind of rhombus grid, and I think that that's because of various existing routes which he wants to incorporate. I'm not sure there is that much more to say about it. I mean, yes, it's incredibly influential. All those early Cool House projects, the early OMA stuff, the Voluntary Prisoners of Architecture, it's all, I think, very consciously in this mode. I mean, yeah, you see that his control of graphics, his real mastery of drawing, which I think is very important. It's very important in the way that he's able to have an impact.
What do you think he was trying to say with this image?
Well, I think that the thing has been halved, and it's very obviously a comparison between the scale of one and the other, the uniformity of the one above and the mess of the one below.
But he is, I think, in this image proposing to keep the bottom bit, albeit with the huge motorway driven through it, and he is proposing to cut it like a knife.
Yeah, you can see the surgery. The surgery is in progress. Yeah, and you can see a little bit of this strange square creeping into the top right corner.
I don't, having looked at it, think it's actually a literal part of the plan voisin. I think it is just graphical presentation.
Yeah, it doesn't... I don't think you could really locate it. He obviously did an awful lot of drawings for this, for the exhibition. It's not a very good reproduction, but there's this aerial view of all of the enormous towers. They're kind of cruciform, but then toothed in plan, so that they create these very stark shadows in the various renderings. And you can see the Seine in the foreground.
Although he never draws the dark side. One side of it is perpetually shrouded in darkness.
Yeah, he's not drawing that. Yeah, the park has all become...
It's all there. Probably half of the figure ground is parkland.
All the same, it comes across as a little bit perfunctory because the relative scale of the tower to the parkland is such. The park all feels a little bit like this little puddle of greenery that it's sitting in.
But this is very like what it actually was like, isn't it?
Yeah.
That parkland is very much like post-war parkland. It's maybe like one of the better examples, like Roehampton, but it has more sort of infrastructure in it. I think we've both lived in buildings with this sort of parkland outside it. It can either be a sort of drifts of plastic bags or, depending on the people who live there, nicely manicured and sterile. Around towers, it doesn't tend to be a house, a place of sort of children's gay laughter.
Exercise of dogs?
Exercise and excretion, yes.
Yeah. So should we talk about the question of influence? Because
yeah.
This plans... its infamy, its status in a sense as the kind of original sin of international modernism. This is what pollutes everything which comes afterwards and leads people into all sorts of unpleasant and vicious follies. I think it needs to be unpacked a bit.
Sure.
And I think it needs to be unpacked because there's so much in here. Much of it is pernicious, but it's in different ways. And I think that the problem of lumping everything in under the infamous image of bad modern architecture is that it's fundamentally leads to purely kind of conservative response, where it's like, well, just don't do anything, or build houses that look like houses or whatever, or you know it, or it doesn't lead to a productive critique unless you really, I think, break it down into its constituent
it's
parts.
Funny because it or an irony is that the response to this has led to an urbanism far more reactionary and commercially driven than the one that preceded it in the Anglo-Saxon world, anyway. Well, in England,
yeah.
It led to, I think, one of the worst periods of sort of civil thought.
I'm not sure what you can really say in its favour, particularly. I think the important thing, and it's a precedent which he himself is explicit about, is that actually this had been done within living memory in Paris already on a pretty large scale, and that the sort of Haussmann demolition of Paris had been going on, you know, between 10 and 20 years before he'd been born.
Well, 20 to 30 years.
It was significantly closer. Yeah, I mean, it was significantly closer to his time then than this proposal is to us now.
It was 60 and a bit years prior, and this is now nearly a century ago, 90 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it had the same sort of relation then that I guess the many of the projects of the post-war do to us now in time. And the reason why he's put them where he has is because he's knocking down the remaining non-Haussmannized bits of Paris.
There's a moment when he says, here's a picture of the Marais, which is now just about the sort of richest and most fashionable bit that's got some French people in it, and says, is this the seventh circle of hell?
But then people thought that about lots of places, didn't they?
I mean, well, they probably had more scenic poor people in them back
yeah,
then.
Yeah. Even in the post-war period, I think people aren't aware of quite how abject a lot of these now very, bobo areas really were. That they were lots and lots of houses. They were filthy. They didn't have any sanitation. And although people were wrong to identify them, therefore, as kind of irredeemable slums, which had to be cleared and terminated with extreme prejudice, you can see much more where the idea came from or how they got it into their heads. I think it's less outrageous, or its context is a lot more complex than people have tended to recognise.
In the moment, it's obviously a provocation.
I don't think it's serious.
Do you think if someone had said, let's do it?
I think he would have been up for knocking down some bits of Paris.
I think without a shadow of a doubt, he would have been totally happy to knock everything down that he knocks down in this and replace it tabula rasa. I don't think he would have any problem with that.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have looked like this. And I think also that his attitude to history, he sees historic buildings rather like people see, the Mona Lisa, whatever. It's a kind of movable. It's an item. It's an object.
Well, that itself isn't that insane. I mean, they'd moved a number of buildings for Haussmann. He chose the sort of test 10 best buildings, and they just moved them.
He's drawing on the parts of existing theory and practice that he wants. Obviously, he has a kind of wrong-headed conception of history, which is that you can just pluck all of these little pearls of heritage out of the urban fabric, and that they retain some meaning even isolated in Parkland.
But actually that it also completely destroys the character of the city, its social networks, and makes their recreation nigh on impossible by a pernicious urban form. I actually think this sort of urban form of like big towers with nothing between them is pernicious. I think the bit that's most wrong, more wrong in urbanism than the bit that talks about the current city, is the bit that talks about the universal city. Like, the idea that one of the great things about the universal city is that it is grid-like is a totally asinine observation. It's complete nonsense. It can be grid-like or it cannot be grid-like. It makes almost no difference.
One of the things which is interesting about the examples which he cites, so, Beijing, yeah, it was a grid system, but then when you come off the grid, everything is these completely irregular courtyard houses. So the grid exists at a certain scale, but then the inhabited experience of the city then sort of departs from the grid at certain points. It's something which sometimes obtains and sometimes doesn't.
I'm totally grid agnostic. That another thing that's really important about cities is primal shapes. That's nonsense. I don't think actually we said this. I should have said this when we were going through. Everything he says in urbanism is nonsense.
Grids, right angles,
they're both nonsense.
Primary form.
That's nonsense.
Especially in urban spaces.
Yeah, his idea about order in urban spaces is complete. Is actually the the first lot of things are I'm agnostic about. I think it doesn't make any difference. His notion about urban space is actively the opposite of right.
I'm not sure what else there is. Then there's just all of the car stuff. Yeah, I think that it's very difficult to sympathise with any of the ideas, really. And I think that he has a great feeling for what makes a building pleasurable to experience and to enjoy. But I think he really doesn't understand cities.
I'm not sure he even really understands the occupation of houses. What he's really good at is space and promenade.
Maybe we should return to the point that we started at, which is that all of these things are displayed at this international exposition of decorative arts, which was a big success. So it has the pavilion has two parts. There's this sort of elliptical bit which has all the exhibits of the cities of the future in it, and then there's this little individual module which is a module from one of the slab block typologies that he's come up with. It's a duplex, it's on two levels. The plan is essentially a square. In one corner of the square, an area which is sort of roughly a third of the overall is cut out and is a double level garden. It's like a complete absence. And then so that you're left with the remainder of the form is L-shaped, kind of inverted L depending on which way around you're looking at the plan. And then the bottom of the L next to the garden is a double height living room. And then the rest of it is, you know, this by now quite familiar mixture of service spaces and relatively modest bedrooms and other things.
It's also kitted out. It's got some elements of his play with circulation.
It's very much, you know, it's very much like vision of better living. It has all of the accessories of the good life, yeah, as well as the essential architectural form.
Industrial products also, the bentwood steam chairs, the club armchairs, and, you know, which is a sort of more slightly, dare I say it, deco-y armchair, a certain amount of purist art.
Yeah, it's got a lot of his paintings. It's got, I mean, the pictures, it does look nice. It looks like a nice...
It's very like Citroën. It's stripped back quite a long way from Villa La Roche. It doesn't have... It's perhaps like the Jeanneret half of Villa La Roche. It's probably the closest thing to, but without as much emphasis on the roof garden and with a simplified circulation. On the outside also, something you haven't mentioned, there's a huge graphic, which I think is a sort of another part of the propaganda. This is combining his urban notion, his big building notion, his house notion, and his graphical sensibility, and his industrial furnishings and things like that, all into one. He's also done something. Normally, I think he's an architect who actually doesn't respond best to constrained circumstances, but because I think he wasn't terribly popular with the conveners of the exhibition, because he'd not been very nice to them, I think, mainly, and very nice about them.
Yeah, I think he's, could be quite difficult.
I think he had been difficult, and I think he then complained, as many difficult people do, of persecution. They'd given him a slightly difficult site with a lot of trees in it, but he's managed to integrate them quite well into the inside of the building.
Yes, yeah, so they're kind of going all the way up through the garden courtyard.
They also built a hoarding so that people couldn't see his building from the outside before the exhibition. Yeah. Which there's an argument about whether or not this is him and his radical style being martyred by the hideous establishment, or just that they wanted to unveil it complete and didn't want to have the building site on display. I don't have an opinion on that, really.
I retain a kind of ambivalence about these works, even though I don't think that they're a good idea in the way that they're proposed. I think for various reasons.
Well, I think their success is a rhetorical one. At a really obvious level, they're a successful piece of rhetoric because they got everyone talking. They got him more famous, rather like as a great flourish at the end of the Esprit Nouveau period. It's very expansive. Also, as a rhetorical device, it sort of... you know how people who, when they want to say something extremely racist or something, they say, "We're just raising the issues." You know, you've just done something really quite despicable to raise. "I'm just raising the issues." Well, it's not complete nonsense. He is creating a piece which allows us to think about these cities before they happened, to start the process of testing the nature of that city. I think the great problem is that it is insufficiently tested. He hasn't, because he is trying to promote the positive aspects of an idea, he fails to examine what, even for him, we can see from his attention, are the weak points.
Yeah, I guess the only point I'm making, which is sort of semi in favour of, or which is suggesting that this is not got, you know, the city hasn't finished evolving, it hasn't finished changing. It's going to go on, and it's going to go on changing a lot. Revolutionary changes in the form of the city actually is a thing which we should still think of as being possible. If it's going to change, we might as well have intentional change rather than this sort of undead process of, like, this kind of London plan sort of change, where I don't think no one has thought, well, actually, this is a really good type, this is what we should be moving towards. Things have just got tweaked around and about, and what we've ended up in with is this particular type, which I think has really serious problems in all sorts of ways. And that it's not like we shouldn't...
But it wasn't just the planning that brought about that type. It was a strange set of policy and just economic conditions, I'd say.
Yeah, sure, but it's still something which you might do intentionally rather than just sort of spectating and occasionally thinking in a vaguely psychogeographical way about how peculiar it is and all this kind of thing. you know, the buildings, the types of buildings with which we populate the future city might as well be something that we actually think about in an active way, rather than something which just kind of happens to fall on our heads.
I'm not sure I would generally advocate replacing one sort of urban condition with something which is massively, like, wholesalely changing it to something else. I don't think that in a mature city like ours, I'm not sure that's often a good idea. Unless it's been brought about by one of the activities of the city ceasing, or a component of the city dying off. You know, if the docks die off in a very big, you've got a major wound, and you're going to have to kind of graft into it in several stages, and you're going to have to change things a lot. It doesn't mean necessarily, it doesn't say very much about what you can do with the building fabric, but like an entire way of life has gone. You can make an intervention, but I don't think that's true in Battersea or here. I think that doesn't mean you shouldn't build big. This isn't an argument for not building big buildings or not having big sites. Yeah. But I think probably I would say, sure, yeah, we should think about those things. But really, I think the problem is that we don't have. The planning is sufficient. Is not interventionist enough, and not sort of deep and skilled enough to carry out a heterodox plan. But I would say that is an argument which is the opposite of, I think, prescriptive, monocultural, finished city proposal. It's a very useful proposal because it tells us what we shouldn't do. Not only that. That's one of the things. One of the things is it shows us a future that we can step back from. And perhaps if more people had looked at it seriously, thought about it seriously, they wouldn't have done everything they did.
Oh God, I mean, we could relitigate all this for a long time. I mean, I think that among the, you know, in terms of these like sterile monocultures, the sort of post-social democratic landscape of the Docklands is,
I think it's got some extraordinarily bad bits in it. You remember like how well they managed to cock up the little bit around where I, like just south of where I was. It's like something which was, it's almost okay now because the natural condition of it is so lovely. It's got such a, you know, a lovely basin, all this sort of old bits of ruinous infrastructure and like beautiful old churches. And then they have managed to just like really sink their teeth into how to make that as kind of mediocre and crummy as possible.
But I mean, all of these effects can be created in a very non-Plan Voisin like architecture, as well as any which claims any kind of descent from it. Okay, well, I think we're going to have to stop talking, aren't we?
Yeah, bye-bye.
All right, thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you very much.
And do keep in touch.
This will probably come out quite a long time after it's recorded. So thank you in advance for all your kind words.
Where do we want to leave people? I mean, from the centre of the 2 kilometre wide expanse of the Ville Contemporaine, as the cars whiz by, you know, the biplanes scudding across under the clouds, we bid you a windswept farewell.